Hello there and welcome. Today is Tuesday, November 22nd, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, Donald Trump continues to interview candidates for his administration. He's also released a video about his first 100 days in office.
I'm going to issue a notification of intent to withdraw from the Trans-Pacific Partnership, a potential disaster for our country.
A powerful earthquake shakes Japan and is followed by a tsunami. Also ahead, the number of people dying of AIDS-related illness worldwide is dropping. It's all on today's International Edition. President-elect Donald Trump released a videotape Monday addressing the American people regarding the actions he'll take on January 1st, his first day in office.
My agenda will be based on a simple core principle, putting America first. Whether it's producing steel, building cars, or curing disease, I want the next generation of production and innovation to happen right here on our great homeland, America, creating wealth and jobs for American workers. As part of this plan, I've asked my transition team to develop a list of executive actions we can take on day one to restore our laws and bring back our jobs. It's about time. These include the following. On trade, I am going to issue our notification of intent to withdraw from the Trans-Pacific Partnership, a potential disaster for our country. Instead, we will negotiate fair bilateral trade deals that bring jobs and industry back onto American shores. On energy, I will cancel job-killing restrictions on the production of American energy, including shale energy and clean coal, creating many millions of high-paying jobs.
Trump also seems to be trying to get some important cabinet jobs settled before he heads to Florida for Thanksgiving. His visitors Monday in New York included former U.S. Senator Scott Brown and Oklahoma Governor Mary Fallon, who's being considered to head the Interior Department. Neither said they'd been offered a post in the administration. Senior advisor Kellyanne Conway said of the visitors,
"Not everyone who has been interviewing with him and giving him advice and sharing their experiences and their vision for America, not all of them will be in his cabinet or be in his federal government, but they all are incredibly important in offering their points of views, their experience, and certainly their vision for the country, and he very much appreciates that."
Well, no one was saying whether Trump would announce more appointments before heading to Florida for Thanksgiving. He was planning to leave Tuesday or Wednesday to spend the holiday at his Mar-a-Lago estate, while Vice President-elect Mike Pence will spend Thanksgiving in Mississippi, where his Marine son is stationed. Here are some of the stories we're following at voanews.com. IS claims a Kabul Shiite mosque blast that killed 32. Syrian and Russian forces pound eastern Aleppo for a seventh straight day. Police in Texas arrest a suspect who they think killed a veteran cop. 3D technology lets blind museum-goers experience the kiss. Find expanded coverage of these stories and more at voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. VOA's International Edition continues now. Well, during the campaign and now following the election of Donald Trump, economists have been trying to assess how his plans for cutting taxes, building a border wall, and other policies will impact the U.S. economy. Joining me now is Dallas-based real estate attorney, energy attorney, David Drum. Thanks for being with us. Now, on Wall Street on Monday, David, U.S. stocks ended the day in record territory with big gains led by energy. What's your overall thought on how the economy will fare going forward?
From a long-range point of view, the main concern I would have is that there's talk of both massive infrastructure spending, public spending, and also the possibility of tax cuts. And when you put those two together, that creates pressure on the federal debt and the deficit. And that could weaken the dollar and lead to higher interest rates that the Treasury has to pay. And in the long run, that combination could dampen the overall economy.
If the Fed seems poised to raise that key interest rate pretty soon, it would seem that we're starting to level off. If that happens and then all these plans go into place, what do you see potentially happening with the U.S. economy?
Even if they raise the rates, the Fed, that is, you know, a quarter point, a half point here, you know, unless they raise it 2 or 3 points out, it doesn't give them a lot of ammunition to work for, you know, if we need to have some kind of monetary stimulus. There really is not a whole lot left in the arsenal. So if we have another shock to the system like that, I'm concerned the Fed's run out of plays to run, so to speak.
How concerned are you that we'll see another shock to the economy?
I'm fairly concerned. The short-term euphoria like today is kind of off of sentiment and not off of fundamentals, and how the fundamentals play out is yet to be seen. But, you know, the pluses and minuses of the spending and the taxes, you know, we're ultimately going to, we're already at record levels of debt to GDP. And if we get that ratio up higher than it is today, we're in unprecedented territory, and I have a real concern about the shock to the economy that we're going to see in the next 4 years.
Donald Trump has talked a lot about bringing back coal. There's a lot of controversy surrounding coal and the reasons the demand has gone down for that, because there are cleaner, more efficient, and it would almost seem like other forms of energy are more economically efficient as well. Does that concern you at all, to try to bring back something that seems like it's sort of run its course?
Yes, definitely. I think there's a definite progression in terms of the intensity of the energy that you can get out of, you know, a given volume of substance that you know moves from coal to oil to natural gas. There's other issues with nuclear, but you know, nuclear would be higher on the chain. And not to mention the externalities of the carbon emissions. And so if you combine that less dense fuel source with the carbon, you know, as you suggest, it's not as efficient, and there's more negative externalities resulting from it. And so to roll back the progress to, just for the feel-good fix of getting jobs, it's, to me, a little bit like the blacksmiths when they went from, you know, horses to automobiles. You know, sometimes certain jobs are not in the path of progress, and what's needed is more of a retraining, a reutilization of the talent than artificially creating those kind of jobs. And so that's my concern with the manufacturing sector in large part too. You know, I think a lot of the problem with the loss of manufacturing jobs is technology, not that the Chinese or somebody else are stealing it from us. I mean, that may be a small factor, but I think a lot of it is simply that we're moving from the industrial age to the informational age, and what's needed is a educational retraining of the workforce and not just spending money to bring back those jobs.
Well, let's hope that the stock market continues to soar either way. Dallas-based energy and real estate attorney David Drum, thank you for your time. Well, the nation has seen a dramatic uptick in hate crimes over the past year and since the election. Joining me now is Ryan Lenz with the Southern Poverty Law Center, an organization that monitors hate groups. Ryan, what are you seeing?
701 incidents of hateful harassment, both verbal and physical, since Election Day.
What sorts of things are you seeing?
We're seeing instances of vandalism where cars are being tagged with swastikas and phrases like Heil Trump. Physical assaults where people who are voicing their displeasure with Trump, with the results of the election, are being physically assaulted in public. We're seeing a good number of instances in schools where children have clearly been affected by the bruising campaign that led up to this election, where, you know, white students are parading through the halls of schools holding Trump-Pence campaign signs and screaming white power. These are typically the behaviors of racists who have existed on the relegated fringe of our culture. And this type of conduct and this type of ideology should have no place in public discourse.
It would seem maybe somehow they've found a voice. Is Donald Trump to blame, or is this just an underlying issue within our society that we didn't see? How do you explain all this?
Well, I think that's a very good question, especially in the aftermath of an election where the polls seem to say or suggest that, you know, where the American people were. But what we're obviously, the polls were wrong. So the question that everyone is asking themselves right now is, well, what does this all mean? What did we miss? What did we not understand? And I think the answers to those questions are probably forthcoming in the days, weeks, months, and years ahead. But one thing is for certain is that as a result of Donald Trump's surprise victory, and for that matter, decisive victory, I think we can say that the waters of racial resentment in this country run very deep, and they were much more turbulent than we imagined.
What about some of the folks that Donald Trump is either considering or has already brought on to be a part of his new administration?
Well, I think they indicate just exactly what's in store, or at least the possibility of what's in store over the next 4 years. It's an interesting sort of two-sided approach because, you know, as Donald Trump said on his 60 Minutes interview, he asked his supporters who have been energized into violence or violent expression as a result of his win to, as he said, stop it. But then the next day, he appoints Steve Bannon, the chairman of Breitbart News, as chief strategist to his White House. And what that does is sends a message that Steve Bannon and Breitbart, which he declared to be the media wing of the alt-right, which is basically a white nationalism and white supremacy rebranded for the digital age, it means that they have a place at the table. And they have a very influential one, because as we go forward, I don't think anyone's going to have Donald Trump's ear more than his closest advisors and cabinet members.
What would be the appropriate response at this point to all the hate crimes? Should Trump wait until he's actually sworn in to address this?
Well, he told his supporters to stop it. And, you know, and what struck me by, you know, with his admonishment of people who were doing this was that it was simply just, it came across like a parent scolding a child. You know, there really wasn't any sort of true acknowledgement of the ideologies that have been energized in ways they haven't been in decades as a result of what he said to them and what he's ultimately promised them in his policy. These are basically dreams delivered for white nationalists, for people who wanted to preserve or want to return to a country that is almost exclusively a white ethno state. So, you know, it's a troubling reality as we go forward over these next 4 years, because it seems that everything that Donald Trump said on the campaign trail, which many dismissed as sort of, you know, just made for television drama and excitement, are actually what he's going to do.
All right. We appreciate your perspective. Ryan Lenz with the Southern Poverty Law Center, a group that monitors hate groups. A powerful earthquake off the northeast Japanese shore Tuesday sent residents fleeing to higher ground and prompted worries about the Fukushima nuclear power plant destroyed by a tsunami 5 years ago. Lines of cars were seen snaking away from the coast in the pre-dawn hours after authorities issued a tsunami warning and urged residents to seek higher ground immediately. The warning was lifted nearly 4 hours later. Here's Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe on the warning.
They observed a tidal wave of 60 centimeters, and also in Onahama it observed 90 centimeters of tidal wave. As of 7 a.m., at least 1,000 people have evacuated to city centers. And the local observatory held a press conference and says that since the tidal waves will return to come repeated times, so never to get close to the coastal areas.
Well, Japan is reporting the quake is a magnitude 7.4, which struck in the same region that was devastated by a tsunami in 2011, killing some 18,000 people. VOA's Victor Beatty spoke with geophysicist Rafael Abreu at the U.S. Geological Survey, who said by their measurements, it registered as a 6.9 quake.
If you look at the location of the quake in the map, this quake is actually closer to the shore. It didn't really happen on the trench when we had the 9.0 Tohoku earthquake of 2011. I'm looking at the moment sensor, which pretty much also gives us an idea of what type of fault movement happened, and it's totally different movement. This is a normal fault as opposed to the thrust fault that was created by the Tohoku quake of 2011. So technically speaking, what we're seeing, this is all the type of seismicity that we would expect to see in the area, especially since it's closer to the shore. We definitely would expect to see normal faulting occurring on this location, which is pretty much what we're seeing.
Well, it was not only close to the shore, but it was also at a fairly shallow depth of, I believe, about 11.3 kilometers.
That is correct, yes. And all of this, from a tectonic point of view, yeah, this is the type of quake that we would expect to see in this particular region and area.
And these apparently occur fairly often, do they?
Yeah, Pretty much. Actually, in the case of Japan, and we got to take into consideration that their seismic program there, it's top-notch, okay? And it's pretty much in response to the fact that, yes, this is a very seismically active area, region of the world. Now it has one of the five largest quakes in history. So these type of quakes are pretty normal.
What caused this tsunami?
Any type of movement that disturbs the water column. So, for example, if you do any movement underneath on the ocean floor, whether you raise it or if it goes down, which is likely to what happened in this case, that type of disturbance is going to create a disturbance in the water column, and that is what creates the tsunami.
Is it the magnitude that determines the size of the tsunami?
What really determines the size of the tsunami is basically the disturbance in the seafloor. And obviously, a larger quake is definitely going to create a larger disturbance. But also, what also determines me is the size of the tsunami is the type of fault motion. Okay, in the case of the Tohoku, what you had was a reverse faulting or thrust faulting, meaning that a huge chunk of the ocean floor all of a sudden lifted, the equivalent of more of three stories high. And when you get that level and that amount of disturbance in the water column, you're definitely going to create the tsunami that you saw, that we saw in 2011. This particular case, what we are seeing is definitely that, you know, whatever the disturbance was, whether it was because the seafloor either subsided or lifted, or simply because it could have been an underwater landslide, which is the other thing that can generate a local tsunami, it's definitely not on the same scale as the 2011 event.
All right. Well, meanwhile, a strong earthquake rattled parts of New Zealand on Tuesday, but there were no reports of damage or injuries. The magnitude 5.6 quake there struck off the coast of New Zealand's North Island. There was no tsunami warning issued. Turning now to what is trending on social media, we're joined by G. Abby Lee. G, people are talking a lot about this big quake in Japan.
Hi, Lori. That's right. Like you mentioned, a tsunami warning was issued. Mutoko Rich is one of the first person to tweet about it, and she's the New York Times Tokyo bureau chief. And if you want to see what's happening live, NHK News has a live feed.
Okay, well, what else is trending?
President-elect Donald Trump held an off-the-record meeting with some media insiders on Monday, and even though none of the attendees commented or tweeted about the meeting, observers still talked about the meeting itself online.
Well, first of all, who were the attendees?
That's one of the first things you can check out on Twitter, and it looks like the attendees were from the five commercial networks, namely Fox News, CBS, ABC, CNN, and NBC. Some of the household names here in America that attended the event are Lester Holt of NBC, Wolf Blitzer of CNN, and Jeff Zucker, who is the president of CNN International. There are photos of some of the attendees walking into the venue.
Okay, so what else are people talking about regarding this meeting?
So one of the points journalists are making is the fact that it was an off-the-record meeting. Jennifer Epstein, who I mentioned in our previous segment, is a politics reporter with Bloomberg, and she tweeted, "No presser for Trump in 12 days since election and just one major interview. And now TV executives and anchors are meeting with him off the record." As you know, the one major interview she's referring to is his 60 Minutes appearance. She also tweeted she hopes those in the attendance have pushed him to talk not just to their organizations, but to a broader audience. On the other side of the spectrum, Sean Hannity, who is widely known as a Trump supporter, also tweeted. He said the president-elect is more gracious than he would be by meeting with network executives that tried hard to, in his own words, defeat him, and tagged CNN and NBC News. Back to you, Lori.
All right. Thanks, G. We appreciate it. Follow her on Twitter at G. Abby Lee. You're listening to International Edition on VOA.
News happens around the clock. And VOA brings you the latest at the top of each hour.
This is Joe Palca.
I'm Victor Beatty.
Francis Alonso.
Tune in for a summary of the news at the top of each hour, around the clock on The Voice of America. Hourly newscasts on the radio and on the internet at voanews.com. VOA, a leader in news coverage for over 70 years.
Jazz America.
This is Russ Davis, and on my program, Jazz America, I carry on the tradition begun decades ago by the great Willis Conover by exploring the wonders of a century of jazz history. I'll cover it all from Dixieland to swing to bebop to modal, free jazz, fusion, world jazz, contemporary, and beyond. Plus, you'll hear the words of the artists themselves as they tell their incredible stories. Join me for Jazz America, Saturdays and Sundays at 13 hours Universal Time, online at voanews.com and the Voice of America.
This is VOA's International Edition. In advance of World AIDS Day on December 1st, a new report finds that more people with HIV than ever before are receiving life-saving treatment, leading to fewer deaths from AIDS-related illnesses around the world. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from UN AIDS headquarters in Geneva.
The report says just over 1 million people died from AIDS-related causes last year, compared to twice that number a decade ago. UNAIDS says this is because of the large number of people with HIV, 18.2 million, who now have access to antiretroviral treatment. The agency also says the world is on track to reaching the target of 30 million people with treatment by 2020. Peter Geese is director of the UNAIDS Strategic Information and Evaluation Department. He tells VOA the disease can be conquered if the necessary investment is made in scaling up HIV treatment and prevention programs.
We estimate that if indeed, like, the funding is there and the coverage targets that are set out to be achieved by the year 2020, then that will lead to ending the HIV epidemic by the year 2030. If the money isn't there, then it is, like, almost impossible to achieve that end.
Currently, the agency has $19 billion to spend on HIV/AIDS annually. UNAIDS estimates it will need $26 billion for each of the next 7 years to achieve its goal of ending the epidemic by 2030. As in previous years, sub-Saharan Africa remains the region with the highest prevalence of HIV/AIDS. Geese says young girls transitioning to womanhood, particularly in that part of the world, are at high risk of becoming infected with a virus that causes AIDS.
There is evidence presented in the report that shows that young women between the ages of 15 and 19 represent a very large majority of new infections in that age group, ranging up to 90% in some studies in Southern Africa.
Geese says these young women usually do not know they are HIV positive, so they do not get treatment and are likely to spread the disease to others. The report finds nearly 37 million people are living with HIV, and worldwide, 2.1 million people became newly infected in 2015. It says there have been no declines in new HIV infections among adults since 2010. But the report notes new HIV infections among children have decreased by 50% since 2010 to 150,000 last year. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Well, the sound of music is silence for those who cannot hear, unless, of course, they're sitting on the musical sofa. Faith Lapidus has details.
This is not an ordinary studio. Everything in it, the lights, the video monitor, and especially the sofa, has been designed to allow students at Karachi's Deaf Reach School to experience music. While deaf people can feel the physical vibrations of a pulsing rhythm, Koch Studio for the Deaf is a true multi-sensory experience, one that's actually directed by the music being played. In this case, it's performances from the popular show Koch Studio. Engineer Awe Siddiqui says the musical sofa uses Chinese technology. It's fitted with sensory motors, which provide the feel of the drums and percussion instruments based on the frequency they produce. But that's not all.
देख भी सकता है कि क्या म्यूजिक चल रहा है और फिर पढ़ भी सकता है कि लिरिक्स क्या हैं।
Anam Hashim raved about the experience to her classmates.
As I sat on the sofa, I saw the lights and experienced the vibrations. It was my first such experience, and I enjoyed it a lot. And I hope to sit and relax like this again. I had never listened to music before, so I was overwhelmed by this visual and sensory experience.
As other students take a turn in the Koch studio, school director Sarah Sheikh says the project is an exciting development for the estimated 9 million Pakistanis who have some form of hearing impairment.
Well, this essentially means that a student or an adult who's deaf and has never experienced music before can actually walk into a customized room which has the whole equipment set up for them. That means that they can watch the singer with their facial expressions, the lyrics are panning down at the bottom, the lights are moving, the sofas are moving. It's an exciting experience.
An experience many thought they could never have. Faith Lapidus, VOA News.
I'm James Butte, host of Daybreak Africa. Join me every weekday mornings at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC as we bring you the latest in African news, features, and sports. You can also be a part of the show through our listeners' mail segment. Just send your views to daybreakafrica@voanews.com or call us on 202-205-9942. That's Daybreak Africa, your breakfast show at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC on the Voice of America.
Well, that's going to do it for today's show, but you can find us anytime at voanews.com. Thank you so much for joining us, and thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Robert Lewis. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have a great day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
There is a dangerous global trend in violence against journalists. Indeed, a growing number of journalists are being targeted by violent extremists and transnational criminal organizations, said the spokesperson for Democracy, Human Rights, and Labor Affairs at State, Mario Crifo. Organizations such as Daesh in Iraq and Syria, extremist militias in Libya, Al-Shabaab in Somalia and Boko Haram in Nigeria have brutally attacked journalists who threaten to bring the truth of crimes and corruption to light. The Committee to Protect Journalists, or CPJ, estimates that as many as 40% of crimes against journalists are committed by these kinds of groups and their supporters. One of those killed was Sami Jawdet Rabah. He was abducted in October 2015 by Daesh fighters in Syria, brutalized and later killed, with a video of his killing made available for the entire world to see. He was a reporter for the Syrian Observatory for Human Rights, working to document the abuses of the Syrian regime and of Daesh. In June 2016, Sagal Salad Osman was attacked and gunned down in Somalia. She was a reporter with Somali National Television and Radio Mogadishu, where she worked to give voice to Somali demands for an end to the violence there. As President Barack Obama has said, the world is a better and stronger place when individual conscience and a press that is free are allowed to function. In order to achieve that vision, the U.S. has made a major reinvestment in the Securing Access to Freedom of Expression initiative. Dubbed SAFE, the initiative provides training in digital and physical security to journalists through regional centers to help them do their jobs while avoiding targeting. In addition, each year, the Department of State conducts an annual Free the Press campaign, which highlights the stories of journalists who have been imprisoned around the world and calls on governments to release them. the U.S. will continue to work to eliminate impunity for crimes against media professionals. Not only is that the right thing to do to secure justice for journalists and their families, it is essential to achieving the goal of a press that is free to report the truth.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com/editorials.
It's 4 hours.